you nominate me, you can set your clock to January 20th, 2025 at high noon, because on the west side of the U.S. Capitol, I will be taking the oath of office as the 47th president of the United States. No excuses. I will get the job done.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a few hours ago, formally launching his long-expected 2024 presidential campaign. He made the announcement during a live Twitter conversation this afternoon with CEO and right-wing provocateur Elon Musk. Media outlets across the political spectrum, including Fox, called it a disaster.
So they just keep crashing, huh?
Yeah, I think we've got just a massive number of people online, so it's servers are straining somewhat. All right, we're just reallocating more server capability to be able to handle the load here. It's really going crazy.
He wasn't kidding. Hot mics, feedback, long, inexplicable periods of silence, a crash and restart half an hour later. DeSantis's team tried to spin it as the governor's popularity, quote, breaking the internet. But with an audience of just a few hundred thousand, it was far fewer than what he could have had on, say, a cable news channel like Fox. An extremely online campaign kickoff is how the online news outlet Semaphore described it. I spoke with their editor-in-chief, Ben Smith, earlier today before the Twitter Spaces event with Governor DeSantis. And the first thing I asked him was, why Twitter and not a traditional cable TV channel?
For Republicans, there's really only one place to announce that you're running for president, which is Fox News. And so in some sense, the biggest surprise is that he's spurning Fox, and that, you know, Twitter and Elon Musk's Twitter have sort of emerged as a major alternate place for conservatives to make news.
Right. And he will do an interview later with Trey Gowdy on Fox News, but he is doing the first one with Elon Musk. Why Elon Musk?
I think for DeSantis, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, one is that Elon Musk is one of the richest men in the world and surrounded by other very rich people who will support his campaign, which is a meaningful thing when you're running for president of the United States. The other is, you know, Musk is, I think, a bit of an icon to conservatives, you know, partly because he's so annoying to progressives. I think a lot of, you know, right-wing politics right now is about, you know, saying things that irritate Democrats, and Musk is great at that, and has on Twitter, you know, really attacked, you know, established media institutions in particular in a way that has pleased Republicans.
But does he run the risk, DeSantis, of looking like Elon Musk's younger brother? Like Elon Musk, even though he's awkward too, has a pretty commanding personality. People like to watch him. Could he outshine Ron DeSantis?
Yeah, I mean, I do think a big risk for DeSantis is that he looks like the smaller person on that stage. For a particular slice of the Republican audience, by the way, not all of them, Musk is a interesting figure who's this heroic entrepreneur character. And I think DeSantis feels like it's cool and interesting to be associated with him. I'm not sure there's that much more to it than that.
Right. Okay, but what does this say about Twitter and its emergence as the place where the right-wing politicians and chattering classes want to be? Does it now have more power now than it did maybe 6 months ago?
You know, I think Twitter matters to conservatives now and to the right wing more than it did 6 months ago, and less to everybody else. It's increasingly becoming, and Musk is pushing it that way, you know, a space, a competitor of Fox News in the right-wing media. The other sort of feature of this moment is that so much of right-wing politics is about cultural controversies that really live and die on Twitter to some degree, or certainly start there. Arguments about gender, arguments about Ron DeSantis's fight with Disney. These are things that almost exist solely for Twitter. But I think there's a real contrast with Donald Trump and his campaign, which was divisive, which was, you know, culturally divisive, which had many, you know, which DeSantis in some ways is imitating and trying to supplant. But the issue that Donald Trump ran on, the divisive hot button issue he ran on, was immigration. And that was not an internet issue. That wasn't a Twitter issue. That was a issue that lots and lots of Americans were upset about, and that Donald Trump was appealing to people who the Republican Party had maybe been trying to play this down and been trying not to appeal to people's anger on immigration. And Trump tapped into that. I think there's a big question of whether there are lots of voters who really care about, you know, Ron DeSantis's promises to stop the woke Twitter mob. It's not something that impinges people's daily lives in the same way.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, though, because he did win his reelection bid by commanding like 19, 20 points. And maybe that was to some degree because his competitor, Charlie Crist, was not a great candidate. But that is a huge margin. And he did run on quote unquote cultural woke issues. So maybe that is where the base is now. And that could be successful for him as he campaigns.
Yeah, I mean, I think he ran a general election campaign on, you know, largely on his performance as governor during COVID when he kept schools open. I would say that was probably one of the biggest issues and something that people in Florida really appreciated. And I think that, in a way, was a huge central defining issue for DeSantis that is now, in some sense, fading out of date. And I think a lot of the fights about schools and who controls the schools are in some ways echoes of these COVID era fights.
So this book banning and wokeness talk speak is not going to be as resounding, you think, or as resonant?
I mean, that's the huge question, is are these very, very online issues that most parents in Iowa are not losing sleep at night because of the books in the school library? They're worried about inflation. They might be worried about immigration. They might be worried about all sorts of day-to-day issues. The issues Ron DeSantis is talking about are not mostly those. The issues Ron DeSantis is talking about are issues like Elon Musk and his fellow billionaire friends are really, really agitated about on Twitter.
Right. And so maybe that works in an Iowa caucus. Maybe it works in a New Hampshire primary, but not in a general, is what you're saying?
I mean, I don't know. I think it's sort of a test of how much everybody in America has had their brains melted by social media and has confused symbolic fights on social media with things happening in their daily lives. I mean, maybe that's true to a large degree, but in some sense, that's what Ron DeSantis is going to test within the Republican Party.
Right. And meanwhile, you have Ben Shapiro's company, The Daily Wire, putting its podcasts on Twitter. You've got, of course, Tucker Carlson moving over to Twitter. So as we move into the political presidential season, do you see Twitter as just taking up a bigger space in the political and cultural conversation?
I think it's impossible to imagine that Twitter will ever reclaim the kind of space it had in 2016 when it was the center of the conversation about news, culture, politics. I think it has become a really, really important space for specifically Republican primary politics now. But I think, I mean, in some ways, the most interesting thing is that Fox News, which had been this uniquely dominant institution in American politics, the most important institution in the Republican Party, you know, vastly powerful among Republicans, now faces all these challenges. The Daily Wire is another, and you're seeing sort of a conservative media that's splintering among a number of medium-sized things, of which Twitter is one.
Yeah, so Musk invited Donald Trump back, but he hasn't taken him up on that invitation. He has his own Truth Social where he makes his pronouncements, including his reaction today to DeSantis's announcement. So where do you go to find out what Donald Trump is up to?
Well, you can, as you mentioned, go to this website called Truth Social, which really showed the limits of his ability to pull his followers over to a new social network because it's not widely used and not particularly successful. There was an idea for a while that Donald Trump kind of only existed because the media gave him attention and because he had all this juice on social media and because the CNN was showing his speeches. I do think it turns out that when you dial the volume back way, but way back on Donald Trump, a majority of Republicans still really love him and want to vote for him. And it does, I think, actually, in some ways, call into question the notion that he only existed because of social media.
Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of the online news outlet Semaphore and author of the new book Traffic Genius Rivalry and Delusion in the Billion-Dollar Race to Go Viral. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a robotic cop approved for the LAPD is angering civil rights activists. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. There will be a new non-human member of the LAPD. The Los Angeles City Council voted yesterday to allow the department to get its first robot dog. It costs around $280,000, and it'll be paid for by a donation from the private funding group, the Los Angeles Police Foundation. But during the meeting, Martius Quidana, a member of a group called Stop LAPD Spying Coalition, said that the city was risking further surveillance of people.
It's so par for the course that this group hears about explicit violence, explicit disdain from the community about an item, and still chooses to potentially legislate its way out of a potential harm. When there's a clear solution right now, don't get rid of this robot dog right now.
Brittany Mejia is a Metro reporter with the LA Times, and she was at the meeting yesterday. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so what was the scene like? It seemed like it was a little testy there yesterday.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, there was more than an hour of public comment, and there wasn't a single person who talked in favor of having this robot dog. And so it was mostly people expressing their concerns and urging city council to vote no.
Okay, but they voted yes, 8-4 vote. Why does the city council want this item, this robot dog?
Yeah, that was what was interesting. I mean, no one spoke in favor of it yesterday, but, you know, in a lot of the documents, you know, Chief Moore was saying that this is something that would assist with officer safety. It would reduce the potential for violent encounters with armed individuals. They basically made the case that there would be strict ways that this robot would be used. And so that was coming up. And one of the other things the council members approved yesterday was a plan to have LAPD provide actual like quarterly reports on the deployment of the device, where and when it was deployed, and the outcome, to try and have some more oversight.
Well, in general, what is it supposed to do, this dog?
Yeah, so it's basically supposed to be able to get into situation, like it would be deployed in a limited set of circumstances that require SWAT team response. So this is a robot that can climb stairs, open doors, navigate rugged terrain. And so it has like 360-degree cameras, and its whole purpose is really to collect, process information, transmit it to officers who are controlling their movements with a tablet-like device. And so it's supposed to help officers avoid unnecessarily being put in harm's way and avoiding these violent encounters, potentially, like a hostage situation, for example.
Right. So it could be sent in during a hostage situation, assess the situation, provide video camera footage in real time to the officers below to see what they're dealing with inside.
Yes, exactly. It's like going into spaces where an armed individual could be hidden, you know, so it's basically the argument for it is like, oh, this will allow this dog to go in versus officers going into a very dangerous situation.
Is it also bomb sniffing?
That I don't think it is. No.
Okay. But it can suss out chemical spills.
Yes. It can suss out chemical spills. It has a lot. Okay. It can be customized, mechanical arm to open doors, sensors. Yeah, sensors capable of detecting chemical spills. Yes.
And why does it look like a dog, or why is it designed to look like a dog?
Yeah, that's what's interesting. I mean, it's I was just researching this. It's like almost 28 inches, weighs 70 pounds. It's like roughly the size of a full grown Dalmatian. I'm actually not sure why it's supposed to look like a dog, although I was hearing a lot from activists and people who were like, oh, calling it a robot dog takes away from what we see that is the dangers to it. Like, it makes it sound cute, basically.
Yeah. Except the use of dogs in communities of color has been not welcomed in many instances. So it might be seen as a menacing figure in some places.
Right, exactly. And I think that was what was really being expressed yesterday. You know, the clip that you just played as well. I mean, that was a point that was coming up as well. I mean, there's not a good history in communities. And I think that kept being raised is that there's concern about the potential to use this device to harm and spy on Black and brown communities.
Okay, so break down the vote for us. How did it go? As I said, it was 8-4. Who was for it and who was against it?
Yeah, so is 8-4. Council member Hugo Soto Martinez is the only one who spoke actually at length yesterday, and he was questioning the vice president of policy and government for Boston Dynamics and also a deputy chief for the LAPD, basically pushing back against claims, you know, that it wouldn't be used to over police in communities. And so that was very contentious. But in the end of it, at the end, council members Heather Hutt, Curran Price, and Nithya Rahman voted no on accepting the donation.
Yes.
And then the rest voted yes. I mean, there was two absences. So there was two absences yesterday, but the rest voted yes. And that, I think, the outcome or the result, like people were so angry after the vote that a few got ejected actually from chambers.
Oh, wow. We actually have a clip of tape from Councilmember Soto Martinez, and this is an example of what you were talking about, his tense exchange with an executive at Boston Dynamics, which makes this robo dog, I guess, for lack of a better term. And here's a clip from that exchange.
Has Boston Dynamics entered into any financial contracts with any of the other cities in the United States?
Any customer that purchases the robot is in a contract with us, including a contract that prohibits weaponization or the use of the robot to harm or intimidate any person or animal.
I know that, but I'm trying to get how much money is Boston. So can how much money is the contract with New York?
I believe that's a matter of public record. They purchased two robots, and you're welcome to check.
So do you know it, or are you just trying to avoid my question?
Okay, so the history of this robot in New York, and I think it's around $700,000. The history of this robot in New York is controversial. Two years ago, the former mayor pulled it, but it was reintroduced last month by the current mayor, Eric Adams. And so what is the situation in New York? Is it a similar robot dog? And do people have similar concerns over privacy and possible violations of civil liberties?
Yeah, I mean, Soto Martinez pointed to that, like that deployment in New York City, you know, as an example of like the issue, because their police force acquired that technology in 2020, but it really didn't get widespread attention until the next year. And there was public outcry after a viral video showed the robot with officers during a hostage situation at like a high rise public housing building. And then there was another instance of it at public housing. And so critics were basically saying the device was being used in over-police community, and they were raising concerns about privacy and data collection. So it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, after the outcry, NYPD did break its contract with Boston Dynamics and return the robot. But as you pointed out, you know, this, like as of last month, it's like bringing the robot dog back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so do we know when the LAPD will actually use this thing?
Yeah, I was trying to press them on that today, and they were telling me, I was like, oh, is it possible that this is going to get deployed in the coming weeks? And their only response was, at this time, we do not have an answer for that. So it's unclear whether this will be walking the streets anytime soon.
All right. Brittany Mejia, Metro reporter with the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, a conversation with artist Thomas J. Price, who makes towering sculptures of ordinary people.
As you approach this work, its size increases in relation to your own. And so that sort of, you have to kind of negotiate your understanding of perhaps power or status.
He has a new exhibition here in Los Angeles. Our conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Who deserves to be immortalized as a statue? That question has been part of the reckoning over America's history. And not just America's history. In Europe, too, most statues are devoted to white male war heroes. From his studio in London, Thomas J. Price makes massive sculptures of people, but they're just ordinary folks engaged in the ordinary business of life. You can see many of these sculptures at Hauser & Wirth's Downtown Gallery. It's Price's first major exhibition. It's called Beyond Measure, and it's open now through the end of August. Thomas J. Price, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you very much, Madeline.
Well, tell us about who you choose to immortalize. Who are the subjects of your sculptures?
It's less about trying to create the individual, this idea of the grand individual, this great person, and more about really celebrating what we all share, which are these really kind of these emotional states that connect us all.
So something more universal. What kinds of psychological moments are you exploring?
It could be, you know, you're about to get in the shower, or you're waiting for a phone call, or you're waiting, you know, at the bus stop or something, and you're just with yourself. It's not about pretense. It's not about anything performative. So I think it's really about trying to celebrate the ordinary, but really recognize that the ordinary is quite fantastic given the kind of the nuances and the kind of variables that are involved.
So describe one that we might see it at the gallery. How big is it? How do you make it? What kind of material do you use?
Well, the largest piece in the show is called Grounded in the Stars, and it's a female character who stands at 12 feet tall. So when you take volume into consideration, it's a substantial piece, and you really feel the presence, the physical presence of that character. And she's standing there sort of just with her hands on her hips, quite a casual way, and there's sort of an ambiguity in her expression. So we're not quite sure what is coming across or how she's feeling inside her head. You know, so that sort of hopefully draws the viewer into trying to understand her psychology. And basically, it's like an experiment in empathy, like how we connect to people.
What does it mean to have your hands on your hips this way? What do you think it says?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Well, what does it mean? And uh-huh. I think for me, it's really the whole ensemble of these micro expressions of what she's doing and how she's standing and how the weight shifts. So it's got a lot of connections to classical sculpture in terms of the poses and how shoulders counterbalance the hip angles. So there's a lot of formal elements to it that I think people will recognize from the museums and all these kind of sculptures that we're sort of fed through books and through art history or just through the kind of the tropes that appear on television and magazines. So for me, you know, the hands on the hips as she's holding them, it's a sort of a quite a comfortable, quite self-assured stance.
Yeah, she kind of says to me, I'm looking at a picture of it right now. She says to me, she is here and she's not apologizing for being here.
Yeah.
And she's not intimidating, but she's also not stepping away. So you have to, she's confronting in a way, but not in an intimidating way, except the fact that she is 12 feet tall.
I mean, it's a large figure and it is about taking up space. It is about being unapologetic with one's presence and all the kind of difficulties that can bring, depending on who you are and how people feel that you present yourself. So for me, you know, this show is about sort of creating these opportunities for these characters to take up space for an audience to meet themselves or to meet the sort of the humanistic elements of themselves in a space where they might not have seen people like this standing at this scale in bronze. Mm-hmm. You know, because the bronze sort of process, because it's, you know, it's an expensive process to do. It's time intensive. It tends to be reserved for kind of official statues, you know, the official public statues to aggrandize what the people that history has said or contemporary sort of people in power state as being worthy. And for me, it's an experiment in, this is an experiment in presenting alternatives to those sort of triumphant statues by kind of making sculptures which critique this whole history of monuments.
And are they all people of color?
They are indeed, yeah. Yeah, I've always sculpted people that that are familiar to me. And it was sort of a why not? You know, I used to get asked questions, why do you only sculpt black people? Well, I've never really thought about it like that. I sculpt humans, I sculpt characters that I feel deeply for.
But aren't you also making a political statement by doing that? Because black people have historically not been memorialized, at least not in white Western cultures, in the sculptured form.
Yes. By this stage, yes. But initially, I was making people who looked like me. I was making people who looked like the people that I recognized and interacted with. And so I was really trying to create, the statement was about a humanist stance. And then as I presented these to the public, it became a lot more about resisting the calls for sculpting white people, sculpting more within the, you know, the expected format for what people saw as statues or monuments. And for me, these have always been sculptures. These are works which understand the formal elements of what statues are supposed to do, but they undermine them by kind of presenting an alternative.
And are they all women and girls?
So these are the four of the five figures, the new bronze figures, are female, and then one is male. And so for this process, last year I visited LA, and I did a call out, and I had people actually come and visit me at the gallery space and talk to me about themselves and sort of how they felt they were seen in the world. And I took photographs and took notes about them, and I did some 3D scanning. And then I've used those 3D scans and the photographs when I've gone back to London to basically kind of amalgamate, to put together different elements of these different individuals to create new fictional characters. So they're very much based in the people I met here in LA.
So is there something different in the LA ones, the LA people to the London people?
I don't know. It's, I think people have to come and see, basically, and see if they recognize themselves or if they recognize differences in terms of how people are dressed or how they stand. For me, it's hard to get past the sort of the common element in people, the kind of the thing that unites us. So if there's a more specific kind of take on it from them being in LA, that'd be really interesting to hear what people think.
I mean, it's interesting in a globalized culture, especially you have some of your figures are looking at their cell phone. So it's a reference to the now that people do on the outside, at least, tend to dress similarly and look more the same than different, at least in an urban setting.
So I think that's probably one of the interesting things of this. And that's why these works feel quite global in a sense. Like they could probably place in any country and feel familiar because we do share all those things.
Yeah. And speaking of familiar, when we're talking about sculptures, and you have one called Lay It Down, which is a sculpture just of a head, of a female head. That looks like something that could have been sculpted many, many hundreds of years ago. Yeah. And are you explicitly referring to Greek and Roman sculpture with that?
That work, formally, so in terms of the way it looks, is based on kind of a mix of the Benin heads, ancient Egyptian sort of deity heads, you know, the eyes looking straight ahead, quite a serene look on the face. So there's less of the individualism that comes through Roman portraiture, for example. It's a bit more symmetrical, perhaps. But really, you know, that piece for me was looking at the history of beauty, in a sense, and the history of who gets to have beauty and value attributed to them. And so the baby hairs, you know, the hairstyle, which come just across the forehead and down the side of the hairline. That was really the detail for me that kind of inspired that work. And it was about giving that sort of that style back to the people who created it. It was giving it back to Black women so that it could, the beauty could be attributed to them.
Why do you like working in sculpture rather than, I don't know, paint or any other medium?
I will be introducing some paintings in the show, but I love sculpture. I love the fact that something shares our space. Something is relatable to our understanding of our own scale and our own bodily kind of presence. And I think there's something really powerful in that feeling and that connection, in that negotiation or navigation of another object in a space that you share. And I think it kind of creates interesting sort of moments of discovery with oneself. And when you're trying to kind of make people aware of other people or people's emotions connected to people in society, it's quite interesting to use objects, to use sculpture as a way to kind of recreate sort of almost the environment in which we meet people.
And making them super big is a way that you can't avoid confronting them.
Yeah, so the scale has always been such an important element of my practice. And I used to use very small works, which took up a lot of space, as a way to make people aware of scale and space and power and how these things are sort of communicated. But with these sculptures, they're you know, the smallest one is 9 foot high. And it gives a certain impact, that whether that's indoors or outdoors, there's this understanding of as you approach this work, its size increases in relation to your own. And so that sort of, you have to negotiate your understanding of perhaps power or status with that character presented to you.
And also where they're placed, right? Because now we mainly encounter sculptures in museums, but many of your sculptures are in public places, at least in England. So does that affect how we apprehend your work?
I think the public realm is a place where people feel far more able to critique and ask the questions that they might feel more sort of self-conscious about in gallery spaces. But hopefully, you know, over time, when people get to see the works more, they'll feel more comfortable in gallery spaces or wherever they are.
I'm sure some people are really excited to see some version of themselves in sculpture form when they come across it. But I imagine other people are angry at this. Have you gotten any negative response?
I have done, yeah. And that's sort of what made me realize that I was sort of pushing in the right direction when people did get angry or scared about the works. You know, there's an expectation for who, you know, the type of person he's supposed to be portrayed and the format, you know, so the way that people are supposed to stand, you know, stand up straight, chest out, don't put your hands in your pockets, you know, present this sort of this trope of success and respectability. And so, you know, for me to challenge all of that has got some people angry.
Like, who's angry?
I can't go through the list, but the usual suspects are angry at the works.
To white people?
Well, not exclusively, but I think, there is an element of white people being perhaps slightly scared about what's presented. But to be honest, white people also really respect the works and see themselves in them, because it goes beyond race. It goes to the core of who we are as people. It's more about the idea of success, or the idea of who gets to have that acclaim. And I think, you know, if people have kind of got one set of understandings about how they can climb up this greasy pole, and then suddenly someone's saying, well, maybe there's another way, maybe you don't need to do that, but you've invested yourself in that journey and you've made sacrifices for that journey, then perhaps you're going to feel slightly put out if someone questions your decisions.
Yeah, like, so a girl on a cell phone can be powerful.
Exactly, and can be connected and can be just minding her own business, just like confident in her own space, being able to wear a sweatsuit and still be innocent, be able to, I don't know, slouch and be considered respectable. So there's all sorts of things that, you know, are perhaps buried deeper within the way that I present the works than race. But obviously race is a hugely important element to how people construct value, how people make assumptions about people.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I loved our conversation.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. That's Thomas J. Price. He's an artist based in London. His exhibition at Hauser & Wirth's Downtown Gallery runs through August 20th. Coming up, the owner of the Oaxacan restaurant Galleguetza, Bricio Lopez, has a new cookbook out. It's called Asada, and it's all about outdoor grilling. So just in time for Memorial Day and the summer, the unofficial start of the summer season. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Memorial Day is coming up, which means the official start of the summer grilling season for many Mexican and Mexican-American families here in LA. That means throwing an asada. That's basically a backyard grilling party. And sure, there will be carne asada, but so much more. Beans, rice, tortillas, aguas frescas, salsas, salads, elotes, and it goes on and on. Bricio Lopez teaches you everything you need to know about how to throw the perfect asada in her new cookbook. It's called Asada, The Art of Mexican-Style Grilling. Her family owns LA's preeminent Oaxacan restaurant, Galleguetza, in Koreatown. And Bricio Lopez joins me now. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hi, man. Thank you so much for having
me. It is great to have you. Okay, so this is grilling meat.
And fish. And chicken.
Yeah, right. But mainly meat, right? And
meat.
The grill. Let's just talk about the grill. And why is it such a kind of a dude paradise?
No idea. No idea. Because I was actually having this exact same conversation with a girlfriend this morning. And we were talking about how here in America is so gender specific. You know, Father's Day grilling, get your dad a grill, you know, and everything. But in Mexico, especially in Oaxaca, where I'm from, it's not gender exclusive. In fact, it's women really who handle the comal, who handle the anafres, which is what we call our girls in Oaxaca. And it wasn't really until growing up in the U.S. that I realized that here in America, it is very much centered around dudes.
Yeah. So you're one of only three women who have written a grilling cookbook.
Yes.
And the only Latina. So
the only Latina. Can you believe that? You're
breaking barriers.
Well, I'm just trying to open doors for more. I want more Latinas to grill. Normalize grilling. Come on.
Excellent.
Ladies.
Okay. Well, tell us more about an asada, because it's a backyard barbecue party, right? In essence.
Yes. But there's like so much more than that. And this is exactly what this book is about. Having an asada is almost like a state of mind. If I tell you, Malin, come to my backyard party, it's very different than being like, yo, having an asada, come over. Very different context. Having an asada, you know, there's going to be carne asada meat, of course, but there's going to be ceviche and beans and rice and salsas and corn tortillas and flour tortillas and pollo asado and a lot of beer, micheladas. You'll show up with your bottle of 1942 to impress, you know, the girl next door. Like, you know, it'll be a gathering of people, and there's so many nuances to an asada. They're the people that show up early because they have to get out early. They're the people that show up early and stay from beginning to end. And there's just the people that show up at 5, like, or 6, and like, oh, hey, what's up? Like, yeah, you're asada. And you're like, yeah, we started at 2. You're shopping at 6.
Is there any food left by then?
There's always food. And that's the whole thing. Like, they show up at 6 knowing they're going to get leftovers, but they live for it, because it's like the end, and all the fat and all the juiciness is at the bottom of the pans. Or honestly, it's just the leftovers of the chicharrón and queso and salsa that are left over that you just sort of go and dig through.
Okay, so it sounds really fun to be a guest, but what is it like to host an asada? Is it really stressful?
No, it's not. This is why what I loved about writing this book is really making people understand that food at its core doesn't have to be so precious, right? You can overcook meat. It's totally fine. In fact, if you overcook the meat, that's the best way to have the asada. Everyone loves a crispy, crunchy, burnt meat at the end. It doesn't have to be precious. You don't have to, you know, cut against the grain. You're just ripping meat with your hands. Obviously, don't ever serve undercooked chicken.
Yeah.
Obviously.
You want to have another asada and not kill off your
guests. Yes. But no, it's not. It's just about enjoying yourself, mm-hmm. right? As far as prep work goes, you can start marinating your meat the night before. That's always great. But I think you can marinate meat in the morning, let it sit on your counter, bring it up to room temp. And by the time your guests arrive, it's perfectly seasoned, perfectly marinated for you to just throw it on the grill. And we have some salsas that are very easy to put together. Very, very simple. Beans, rice, and like, you have a party.
Yeah, that sounds so good.
Go to the store, get chicharrón, get cheese, you're done. It's over.
That sounds so simple and so delicious. Well, let's talk about marinating the meat and how you do it. And you have some recipes for carne asada. Tell us about the different ingredients that would go into these marinades.
So we have the clásica, which is very citrus heavy, a lot of cumin. There's beer in there. And this is the recipe that I always tell people that will blow your mind, because when you make this recipe and you taste your meat afterwards, it's going to taste exactly like your favorite carniceria, carne asada. After that, just get into variations. We have a great that's arrachera verde, which is really herb forward. So it's basically just cutting up any herb that you have in your garden or in your fridge or just laying around the house that's about to go bad. You're like, what am I going to do with all the herbs? Cut them up, citrus, lots of salt, oregano, anything that you find, again, and marinating your meat with it. And
what kind of meat?
So the carne asada, what you want to have, I think the most traditional cut of meat is the flap. Flap is so great because it's thin. yet it's not too thick, not too thin. It's wonderful to hold seasoning, wonderful to handle high heat. But I love to have flanken ribs. Flanken ribs, which is what you would find almost, it's almost like a Korean cut that you would find in Korean barbecue. But the flanken ribs cuts, oh my gosh, man, like that. Those are the ones, my mouth's watering. Those are the ones that that you would just go through the fastest. Those are the ones that I find that people gravitate to most because you get that fattiness against the cartilage. You get to tear it open. You get to eat it with your hands. It's just like this beautiful piece of meat that has that bone and that fat all together and it's thin. I love me some flank and ribs.
Wait, so flap is flank steak?
Yes.
Okay. I've never heard the word flap.
Flap, flanken. Flap, yeah, that's what we call it.
Okay. Flap. Flap, okay. So if you go to your butcher or you go to your supermarket, you just say, I want some flap, and they'll know what you're talking about?
Your butcher will cut the flap for you. That way you have, you know, pieces of flap. You marinate them. You throw them in the grill and cut after. I just put them out. I love putting kitchen shears out instead of a fork and a knife just because it's just easier to just cut through and people just grab whatever size piece they want.
Oh, yum. All right, and speaking of grill, what kind of grill is the best?
Well, I think cooking over mesquite is always the best you could do. It just gives you that flavor of carne asada, charcoal mesquite. That being said, it really is up to whoever is cooking that day, whoever is hosting that day, what works for them. I own several grills, but the grills that I tend to use the most are just, you know, my little Weber where I just throw my mesquite charcoal, light it up with a chimney and it's ready to go. And I also love my Traeger, which is a, it's an electric grill, but it uses these wood pellets that infuse the grilling air with whatever flavor you want. So I love using the mesquite wood pellets in my Traeger just because it's easier for me. You know, I have children and sometimes for me it's just easier to like turn on my Traeger and let it come to temperature, put the meat on, close it, and then call it a day. So it just depends on your preference, but mesquite always.
Don't use lighter fluid.
Do not use lighter
fluid. Ew.
Please do not. I feel like I think we're past that. It's 2023. I feel people are not using that anymore.
Okay. Just in case, I had to say that.
Use a chimney to start.
Yeah, for sure. Chimney starter. All right, so let's talk about tortillas. There are the corn diehards and the flour diehards, and you're kind of an egalitarian. You like them both.
Well, let me tell you, I'm from Oaxaca. I am a corn girl, 100%. I'm like team corn all the way. Corn is my heart. Corn is in my soul. Corn is in my DNA. I did not even have flour tortillas until I moved to this country. So I did not know flour tortillas until I was like 15. All that to say that lately I've just been on a flour tortilla kick.
What?
I'm going through my flour tortilla phase. My husband's from the north of Mexico and he's always been team flour. And in my home, I always have both. I'm always the corn person. He's always the, you know, flour. I'm always judging quietly, of course. but lately, I don't know. I feel like low-key I've just been on my flour kick just because, I don't know. That's kind of like where I'm at right now these days. I think because I'm in that asada, northern girl, LA girl vibe. Like I'm right now embracing my LA-ness. I bleach my hair blonde, Madeline.
Oh,
like
my
gosh. I am definitely in a different vibe right now.
All right, okay. So,
but I still love corn though. Corn will always be number one. I'm saying right now, I'm going through my
flower
phase.
All right, that's okay. So, well, you don't make them, right? You don't make the corn tortillas.
You can't. I love making tortillas. So here's the truth: is that when I have friends over and I'm having risas asadas, are you know minimum 30 people to 50, you know, guests at my house, I'm not going to make tortillas for everybody. That's just, I'm not going to lie and pretend. But if I am buying them, I love a brand called La Princesita out here in LA, East LA. They make great corn tortillas. And then for flour, there are two brands that I absolutely love. One is Mejorado. They're out of East LA. And the second one is Caramelo. They make great, great flour tortillas. They make them with avocado oil, which is what inspired one of the recipes in the cookbook. But if you live in LA, you have access to Mejorado Tortillas, and they're the same family that owns Burritos La Palma, and they make incredible flour tortillas.
Okay. Not everyone is a meat eater, especially here in LA. So what are they to eat at an asada?
The vegans and the vegetarians.
They're not invited.
The undercover. They are always invited to the asada. Nopalitos are probably going to be everyone's best friends.
And for those who don't know, cactus. How do you prepare them? How do you take all those little spines off the paddles?
Which is like a little paring knife. I think that's the best way. That's the fastest way to do it.
And wearing a glove, I guess.
And where you can, yeah, you can wear a glove. And cure them with salt always. So once you get all those, the espinas, the thorns out, and you've peeled around, you cut them up and you cure them with salt. So let them sit in salt for about 15 minutes and all that gooiness will come out. Get them out. You can rinse them or you can go throw them directly on the grill right after. And they're delicious.
Okay. Dessert. You have to have dessert.
Gelatinas. My favorite recipe there is my gelatina de mosaico, which is dedicated to my mom.
Oh, tell us more.
So at an asada, you don't want to have cake or... Although people will show up with cake. And it's funny because sometimes I host an asada and the children at the party will be like, Mom, whose birthday is it? And to be like, no one. We just show up with the cake. I don't know. We're just celebrating life, I guess. But gelatinas is the lighter version of that. So I know that in America... You know, gelatin. Is that what you call it? Gelatin?
Yeah,
jello,
like jello.
Jello. Jello. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's not like the vibe anymore, right? People are not really. I think it's very old school. Never goes out of style in Mexico, especially Oaxaca. Gelatina is life there. And my mom is a gelatina queen. Like, she will make the most elaborate gelatinas and she will take forever making sure they're beautiful and she loves her molds and, The iconic gelatina for me would be the gelatina de mosaico. And what you do is you make different flavor gelatinas, different colors. You cut them all up and then you put a tres leches gelatina on top of that, which is white. So you have this white, beautiful mold. And then when you cut in it, it just looks beautiful because it has all those different textures and colors from the other jellos. And I love serving it in small cups. So everyone gets an individual one. And it's such a hit every time just because I think it brings up a lot of memories for people.
Yeah. Sounds like a lot of childhood delight right there.
Yeah.
Gelatina de mosaico, right?
Mm-hmm. And really that one is just about having a great mold. And I think that's why I love gelatina so much because you have a good mold and you would just impress okay. people.
Now I'm salivating. The whole book made me salivate.
Thank you. I'm so proud of this book. Really, this was, you know, Oaxaca, which was my first book, was really the story of my family, of how we came to be, the restaurant's history, the recipes that I grew up eating as a child, the recipes that we serve at the restaurant every day. And this book, Asada, is just like my LA girl side. It's, you know, I've lived in this city for over 20 years and it really, it's at the core, it's really who I am. I'm an LA girl, a Oaxaca LA girl, and this is just all those recipes that embody Los Angeles, the recipes that you see on the weekend parks with the families firing up the grills and all the smoke that lingers through the air as you walk by and you turn around and you see people just having the best time in their jumpers and balloons and there's rice and there's beans and there's meat. And these are those recipes. These are the recipes of the LA people. These are the recipes of the people that make LA so beautiful.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show today and brightening up our day for sure.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here.
My pleasure. That's Bricia Lopez. Her family owns the LA Oaxacan restaurant Gelaguetza. Her new cookbook is called Asada, The Art of Mexican Style Grilling. Rest in peace, Queen. Tina Turner died today at the age of 83. We'll have more on her long and extraordinary life throughout the day right here on KCRW, so keep it locked. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. We'll keep on trying.